When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
When it comes to military intervention in the Middle East, there is one word that sums up British hubris, and that word is Suez. But did Britain learn from one of our most infamous mistakes in the Middle East?
Blair himself, I think, had a remarkable case of historical amnesia. It's a strange thing to say because Blair was interested in history. You know, he studied history, he read history, but somehow or other, I think after 9/11, he thought the world had changed in a dramatic way, and that all previous historical examples, in a sense, weren't relevant.
I'm Ros Taylor, and this is Jam Tomorrow. We don't know how many people died digging the Suez Canal during the 1860s. It was certainly in the tens of thousands. But we do know that Britain did not want a new maritime route between the Mediterranean and the Red Sea at all. You might think that was a bit strange, since a faster journey between Britain and its colony India would be bound to benefit us. And you'd be right. The real reason Britain opposed a Suez Canal was because France was building it. So Britain decided to complain about the fact the men digging it were forced labourers. Whether being fed and paid sixpence a day amounted to slave labour was a moot question in the Victorian era. But once the canal was built, everything changed. The long voyage to Bombay now took only 40 days instead of the 4 months it took to go around southern Africa. In 1875, Egypt was in a financial crisis and was desperate to sell shares in the Suez Canal Company. Britain happily obliged and bought a big stake. A few years later, there was a nationalist uprising in Egypt that threatened trade along the canal. So Britain invaded. A small French pamphlet called The War in Egypt, published in 1882, gives a highly partisan account of the battles and the British victory. But it has a very interesting and prescient conclusion.
England has re-established order on the banks of the Nile. She has declared no territorial ambitions, only maintaining a presence in Egypt and the Suez Canal, which she justifies through the importance of trade and in the service of humanity. But if we look beyond the present, we can see that England's colonial ambitions are in danger. The British Empire, which covers a third of the globe, has shown its vulnerability. The key to the Andes is no longer on the Indus River or in Kabul. It is at Port Said and Suez. It is a canal dug by Monsieur Ferdinand de Lesseps that is today at the heart of English power.
Jump forward 142 years to January 2024. Britain no longer has an empire, but it is still very interested in making sure ships can pass from the Mediterranean to the Red Sea unimpeded. And Prime Minister Rishi Sunak is explaining to the Commons why Britain and France had bombed military targets in Yemen on the Red Sea.
Since the 19th of November, Iran-backed Houthis have launched over 25 illegal and unacceptable attacks on commercial shipping in the Red Sea. And on the 9th of January, they mounted a direct attack against British and American warships. They fired on our ships and our sailors. It was the biggest attack on the Royal Navy for decades. And so we acted. We did so in self-defense, consistent with the UN Charter, and to uphold freedom of navigation.
So this isn't the first time that Britain has stepped in to ensure ships can pass through the Red Sea on their way from the Mediterranean. But the most infamous intervention was in 1956, in what is known as the Suez Crisis. The trouble really began when President Nasser of Egypt decided to nationalise the Suez Canal. It was a provocative move. Nasser was angry that America had refused to finance a new dam at Aswan, and he was using the canal as leverage. Britain and France were outraged. Then Israeli troops invaded Egypt and advanced just 10 miles away from the Suez Canal. PM Anthony Eden told Britons that we in France now had no choice but to send in our own troops.
Then, a few days ago, came the entry of Israeli troops into Egypt. Was that a dangerous situation? Was it likely to lead to a widespread flare-up in the Middle East? In the judgment of the government, it was. Was it likely to endanger widespread British and international interests? It was. Well, it's possible to go on arguing who was the aggressor. Was it Israel because she crossed the frontier? Or was it Egypt for what she'd done before? But that's not the real issue for us. If you see afar, the first question isn't how it started, but how to put it out.
But Eden was not being honest about how it started. In fact, Britain and France had held secret talks with Israel and had encouraged it to invade so that they would have a pretext to do the same. The invasion proved to be a disaster. I talked to Nigel Ashton, a professor of history at the London School of Economics and the author of False Prophets: British Leaders' Fateful Fascination with the Middle East, from Suez to Syria, about why Eden provoked the conflict. Anthony Eden thought that Nasser's nationalisation of the Suez Canal was comparable to Hitler's annexations of the Sudetenland and so on. Why was that?
On the face of it, it seems a ridiculous comparison to make, because we're talking in July 1956 about an Egyptian leader who does no more than actually nationalise the company that runs the Suez Canal. Whereas if you look at Hitler's programme of annexation, yes, it starts off with the militarisation of the Rhineland, the Anschluss with Austria, and it ends up, of course, with the destruction of Czechoslovakia and the invasion of Poland. So, you know, on the face of it, these are things that can't be compared at all. I think to understand it, we've got to recognise, particularly for Eden, Eden had been one of the leading anti-appeasers in the 1930s, as had incidentally Harold Macmillan, who was the Chancellor of Exchequer at the time and an extremely important player in the British government's response. So for Eden, this was an important kind of historical frame of reference, you know, back to the period when he kind of cut his political teeth, if you like. But what was it specifically about Nasser's action that made him think of this historical parallel? I think by this point, July 1956, when Nasser nationalized the Suez Canal Company, Eden saw this as a final stage in a sort of program of action, looking back to Nasser's manifesto, the philosophy of the revolution, which Eden thought was a program which would involve driving Britain out of the Middle East altogether and potentially, through the nationalisation of the Suez Canal Company, strangling Britain economically, cutting it off from its supplies of oil in the Middle East region. And yes, this potent image of strangulation of a man who he saw as a dictator out of the Mussolini and Hitler mould, you know, with his hands round Britain's economic windpipe. That was the frame of reference which he saw it in. Again, I say, if we look back on it historically, it seems an extraordinary comparison to make. But here we're going beyond, we're talking about emotion. There's also an emotional element to the response here.
So he believed he was right, clearly. But why were Britain and France so confident that they could win?
So Britain and France had been the imperial powers in the region. Britain was still the leading outside power in the region in 1956. It still had extensive interests. It had existing treaty relationships still with countries like Jordan and Iraq. Britain was still a significant military power, as was France. So I think in that sense, purely in a military framework, they were confident that militarily they could prevail. I think the difficulty here was more about how did you actually go about launching a military operation? Because Nasser hadn't actually done anything illegal when he nationalized the Suez Canal Company, was perfectly within the rights of the Egyptian government to nationalize the company. So Nasser would only do something illegal if he actually blocked free transit through the canal. So through the crisis, the British government under Eden's leadership was looking for a kind of pretext on which it could launch military action. It was looking for Nasser to do something that was actually illegal that they could justify launching military action with. And that search for pretext is what eventually led to the Anglo-French-Israeli collusion, Britain and France secretly agreeing with Israel that Israel would attack Egypt and that Britain and France would then intervene, posing as peacekeepers to keep Egyptian and Israeli forces apart. Of course, this was hypocrisy. There was no way Britain and France were impartial international peacekeepers. They were very much partial and very much interested in what was going on. But this was the fiction under which Britain and France eventually chose to launch military action against Egypt.
But they didn't involve America, did they? And that was one of the fatal flaws in the plan. And they ended up being told to withdraw by the US. How much of a humiliation was that?
It was obviously a huge humiliation, particularly for Britain, because of the closeness of the Anglo-American relationship dating back to the Second World War and the years of Churchill and Roosevelt. There are still some puzzles here. The United States put Britain under both diplomatic, political, but also economic pressure. There was a run on the pound sterling. I refer to puzzles. The puzzle is why the government wasn't better prepared for that. Why Harold Macmillan, as Chancellor of Exchequer, hadn't applied in advance for emergency drawdown rights on the International Monetary Fund, for instance. Why they hadn't made more preparation for this kind of economic contingency that might arise. And I think here, what we see is the British government, certainly Eden, certainly Macmillan, misunderstanding, or if you like, deliberately misunderstanding what the United States' response was likely to be to military action against Egypt. I think both of them had convinced themselves that the United States would basically sit on its hands, that it wouldn't intervene directly in the crisis, mainly because it was the final week leading up to Eisenhower's re-election. And the assumption was that the presidential election in the United States would keep the United States out of the picture, and that therefore Britain would have time to act without United States intervention. And that proved to be a fatal miscalculation, because the election had the exact opposite effect. Eisenhower was furious that his closest allies had launched a war in the Middle East in the week leading up to his re-election. The election, coupled with the Soviet intervention in Hungary at the same time, made him even more determined to respond firmly to this Anglo-French-Israeli military action.
Does what's going on in the American election scare and bemuse you in equal measure?
Want to know what Biden and Trump are up to without tearing your hair out?
Then you need to listen to American Friction, the brand new podcast about the countdown to the big vote in November from the makers of Oh God, What Now?, The Bunker, and Paper Cuts.
Every Friday, we'll speak to leading experts and blockbuster commentators from the United States to explain the latest news and the big issues behind the vote.
That's American Friction with me, Jacob Jarvis.
Me, Chris Jones.
And me, Nikki McCann Ramirez.
Out every Friday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Eden resigned the following year. As he boarded a ship to take him on holiday to New Zealand, a reporter asked him if he had any thoughts about the Middle East.
I don't think so. Perhaps just this one, yes, I might make. The difference between the West and Egypt has not been colonialism. It is a difference between democracies and a dictatorship. The British people, with their instinctive good sense, have understood that. I'm sure they'll always understand.
What did the Suez Crisis show Britain about itself?
So it's an interesting question. I think it depends who you ask and where you look. There were large crowds who came onto the streets in 1956 over Suez, just as they did in 2003 over Iraq. So large crowds who came onto the streets, and they were demonstrating under the banner of law, not war. That was the slogan. What did they mean by law, not war? They meant whatever Britain did should be done through the United Nations and should be approved and supported by the United Nations, and that the age of kind of gunboat diplomacy, of Britain acting as an imperial power and intervening militarily as it saw fit, were gone. So I think if you ask those people who were out demonstrating against Suez, they would say the lesson of Suez was that Britain from that point onwards had to try and act according to international law. If you ask those in the government, because of course, in a sense, Harold Macmillan profited from this crisis, he became the prime minister after Eden's fall in January 1957, what lesson did he draw from the crisis? I suppose his lesson was not to act unless he was sure about the position of the United States. So it's crucial to emphasize this didn't mean that Britain never intervened militarily in the Middle East again. It did. It sent troops to Jordan in 1958. It sent troops to Kuwait in 1961, just to name the most direct examples afterwards. But in those situations, it made sure that it had fully discussed what it was going to do with the United States and that it wasn't going to encounter American opposition. So again, as I say, it depends who you ask, what lessons are drawn. But for Macmillan, who then became the prime minister afterwards, that was probably the main lesson that he drew from the crisis.
And what did it tell America about us? Did the relationship change in a profound way after Suez?
I think it's in many ways a kind of controversial thing to say, but in terms of the Anglo-American relationship, Suez ended up being a storm in a teacup. You know, from the US side, it's certainly true that Eden's actions dramatically changed President Eisenhower's perception of him. He commented that, you know, it was a terrible thing to have to constantly downgrade your opinion of someone who you'd originally had a high opinion of and worked closely with during the war years. But did it have a broader impact on the Anglo-American relationship? I'd actually say no, it didn't, because pretty quickly afterwards, as soon as the conference in Bermuda in March 1957 between Eisenhower and Macmillan, you know, attempts are already being made then to rebuild the relationship and build bridges. So I don't think in terms of US perceptions that it did have a lasting impact on the relationship.
Were there parallels with subsequent British interventions in the Middle East? Because obviously there was, as you mentioned, further British intervention in Jordan. But then most people listening to this podcast will think of the actions in Afghanistan and in Iraq, and indeed right up until today. Are there lessons that were drawn from Suez which are still apparent now?
Yes. So, I mean, I wrote a book called False Prophets, looking at, you know, British involvement in the Middle East and the successive interventions Britain made in the region under different prime ministers. And I tried to draw attention to some of the less well-known episodes in between in the 1960s and the 1970s. But of course, the big episode that everybody thinks about is Iraq. First of all, of course, the crisis of 1990 to 91 with the invasion of Kuwait, but particularly people think about the 2003 invasion of Iraq. So there were some people in government who were well aware of the legacy of Suez and the example of Suez. For instance, Robin Cook, who had been a foreign secretary leading up to the Iraq invasion, he was the leader of the House. And he notes in his diary that he repeatedly told Tony Blair, he said, you know, all I ask you is that every morning you think of the example of Anthony Eden, you know, a prime minister with a large majority in the House of Commons who fell over questioning military action in the Middle East. Cook wasn't the only one. In the Foreign Office, one of the senior officials, Edward Chaplin, again, repeatedly drew attention to the Suez analogy and said, you know, this operation in Iraq threatens to be another Suez and might lose us the Arab world for, you know, another half a century afterwards. Blair himself, I think, had a remarkable case of historical amnesia. And it's a strange thing to say because Blair was interested in history. You know, he'd studied history, he read history, but somehow or other, I think after 9/11, he thought the world had changed in a dramatic way and that all previous historical examples, in a sense, weren't relevant. You know, we're into a completely new epoch He says in his memoirs, you know, when he draws this tableau of 9/11 and, you know, the horror that came out of this clear blue sky on this, you know, otherwise beautiful morning. He said, after that, I'd become a revolutionary. You know, my whole outlook on the world had changed. So part of that seems to be historical amnesia about the lessons and legacy of previous British interventions in the region, of which, you know, Suez is arguably the most notable. So as a historian, I think I would always be arguing, wherever possible, for policymakers to try to draw on the lessons of history, to try to study their history and not close their mind to it. And in a way, I think that Blair did because of the way he understood the world after 9/11.
France, of course, did not get involved this time. And we had a powerful speech, I recall, from Dominique de Villepin making the case against military intervention. Were they the ones who had learned the lessons of Suez?
Yeah, I think it's probably a little bit of that, but it's more complex as well. I mean, France came to the situation over Iraq with a kind of a different European perspective. France, of course, historically has been much more suspicious of the exercise of, you know, the untrammeled exercise of American power. And France, throughout the debates about Iraq in the 90s, when the policy was to try to contain Saddam Hussein after the Gulf crisis of 1990 to 91, France, throughout that period, in cooperation to agree with Russia, had been calling for an agreed Security Council approved approach to containing Iraq. And as far as the French were concerned, there was no justification to depart from that as radically as the United States and Britain did in 2003. So that's a large part of the picture. If you're talking about Dominique Villepin, his speech at the UN, just on a slightly ironic note, of course, Jack Straw, the British Foreign Secretary, did reply to him, and in terms of, you know, what this is really all about is how are we going to manage the threat from Saddam. And Jack Straw made quite a powerful speech as well. And the British Embassy in the United States got a message from one American listener who'd heard Straw speaking. And she commented that she hadn't fallen in love with a British person as much as Jack Straw since George Harrison in the 1960s. So Jack Straw did have at least one fan after making his rebuttal to Villepin's comments.
Hello, I'm Dorian Linsky.
And I'm Ian Dunn.
We are the hosts of Origin Story, the podcast that unpacks the history behind the ideas, the people, and the events that shape political discourse today.
And we are back for season 5.
We're kicking off with a two-parter on George Orwell, the man, the work, the ideas. We follow him from Burma to Spain, through Second World War London, to the writing of his masterpieces Animal Farm and 1984, and how their legacy is used and misused today.
That's Origin Story Season 5, coming now from anywhere you get your podcasts.
One thing's for certain. British interventions in the Middle East are not over, but we definitely don't call them invasions anymore. I'm Ros Taylor, and that was Jam Tomorrow. Pickups in Marble Arch, gay pubs in Soho, homophobia in Parliament. Have you listened to our episode on the legalisation of gay sex? Hear about the diaries of Mr. Lucas and from campaigner Peter Tatchell. Just search for Jam Tomorrow on your podcast app.
Jam Tomorrow was written and presented by Ros Taylor. The producer was me, Jade Bailey. Music was by Dubstar and artwork by Jim Parrott. The managing editor is Jacob Jarvis and the group editor is Andrew Harrison. The extract from The War in Egypt can be found online at Gallica, Bibliothèque Nationale de France. Jam Tomorrow is a Podmasters production.